Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
Russia plans to manufacture a pretext for its attack. This could be a violent event that Russia will bring on Ukraine, or an outrageous accusation that Russia will level against the Ukrainian government. We don't know exactly the form it will take. It could be a fabricated so-called terrorist bombing inside Russia, the invented discovery of a mass grave, a staged drone strike against civilians, or a fake, even a real, attack using chemical weapons.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the United Nations today outlining the ways Russia could justify invading Ukraine. And on the South Lawn today, President Biden said the threat of a Russian invasion in the next few days is, quote, very high.
We have reason to believe that they are engaged in a false flag operation. They have an excuse to go in. Every indication we have is they're prepared to go into Ukraine, attack Ukraine.
Russia is a master manipulator on the world stage. Look no further than our own 2016 presidential election. And we're going to talk about how Russia has been doing that, manipulating the information and the propaganda with regards to Ukraine with Nina Jankowicz. She's a global fellow at the Wilson Center and author of the book, How to Lose the Information War, Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Ukraine's military shared photos today of a kindergarten that had been hit by artillery shells. Ukraine blamed Russian-backed separatists. The Kremlin didn't address that specifically, but says the first strike came from Ukraine. And so is this an example of what Biden and Blinken were talking about in terms of staging an attack to make it look like Ukraine is trying to start a war?
Well, it's certainly being spun that way in Russian media. There's claims already sprouting up that this was a Ukrainian attack on its own kindergarten, which doesn't make very much sense. But the evidence that we have so far that's been posted online shows that the shelling came from the direction of the separatist-backed region in the south of the kindergarten. So it seems like this shelling came from Russia. And perhaps it was a mistake. Perhaps it is this attempt to create a pretext. We also have in the past several days, President Putin saying that there is a genocide against people going on in the Donbas region carried out by the Ukrainians. There's no evidence for that claim. The OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation and in Europe, of which Russia is a member, actually has full access to the separatist-backed territories and has no evidence of any such claim, even though Russia has now filed a report or is in the process of filing a report with the United Nations that makes those claims, which again would provide such a pretext that we've been warned about from both the United States and United Kingdom governments over the past several weeks.
Right. And just to make it clear, with that shelling today of the kindergarten, nobody was seriously injured. No children were injured. And I think a few staff may have suffered concussions, but that's just about it, just in case people were wondering. But in terms of this allegation of genocide that Russia is making, they haven't provided any evidence of mass graves or anything like that, have they?
No, there's no really fulsome evidence of any sort of genocide or even, you know, poor treatment of those in the Donbas going on right now. In fact, I would argue that those that are guilty of war crimes are indeed the Russian-backed separatists and Russia itself. Russia has been disappearing activists and citizens of the Crimean Peninsula for the past 8 years, especially those of Crimean Tatar heritage. They've just disappeared because they are outspoken against the Russian occupying regime there. There were certainly a lot of war crimes going on at the beginning of the Donbas invasion. And your listeners probably remember the shoot down of Flight MH17, which was an airliner headed for Malaysia that was shot down over Ukraine in the summer of 2014 by a Russian Buk missile that was provided to the separatists by Russia. And all of that is very, very clear from open source evidence that 300 people, civilians, needlessly lost their lives because of this Russian-backed conflict.
Wow. Well, so what are you making of this moment right now? How does it compare to 2014 when Russia invaded and annexed Crimea?
Well, certainly this is a much larger operation. We never saw this concentration of forces around Ukraine's borders before. And we're seeing some defense agencies from Western governments showing potential routes of attack right now that could end up at Kyiv, Ukraine's capital, or other large cities across the country. It's a much, much more concerted effort, a larger effort, and an effort that could potentially change the landscape of Europe more than Russia has already unilaterally changed it in the past 8 years. With regard to information warfare, I think it's important to point out that a few things have changed. In 2014 and 2013, we saw a lot of trolls and bots, similar to kind of what we saw in the 2016 election here in the United States, that were spreading the Russian viewpoint. And now, because of social media companies really taking action against this inauthentic amplification, we're seeing less of that. People are also more wary of accounts that don't have real names and have kind of made up handles and things like that. So we're seeing a lot more top-down disinformation, again, coming from the Kremlin, coming from Putin, being recycled in Russian state-sponsored media, and then being laundered into our own Western information ecosystem by people on the fringes of the political spectrum who have become what we call fellow travelers with Russia, who seem not to recognize Russia's democratic and human rights abuses and are siding with the Russian regime, rather than the people of Ukraine who just want to live in peace and have their political sovereignty be up to them and their country, not their much larger neighbor.
And what kind of messages are being promulgated by the Russians that are making it here and are being repeated by these far right voices?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I should add, it's not just far right. We're also seeing plenty of this on the far left as well, unfortunately. So there are three main narratives. One is that Ukraine is allegedly full of neo-Nazis and that it's a fascist country. Now, Ukraine, like any country, does have some far right figures. Some of them are active in the military, but they do not have political representation. They didn't make it into parliament in the 2019 parliamentary elections. So the idea that the entire country, which has been working tirelessly to get on a democratic path for the last eight years, is full of fascists, just doesn't hold water. That's number one. The second narrative that we're seeing is either that NATO is responsible for this conflict or that Ukraine is responsible for the conflict. That ties in with the false flag allegations that we're expecting. Russia is very much making this conflict about NATO, but it's about control of a former Soviet sphere of influence. And NATO has a right to admit whoever it wants. Ukraine and countries like the Republic of Georgia are pretty far away from NATO membership. They have a lot more development to do and a lot more reforms to make. So the idea that this conflict is about NATO just doesn't hold water because, again, no one is expecting NATO to admit Ukraine anytime soon. And then the third narrative is somewhat related. We hear that it's the Western military and energy lobbies who want this conflict, and they're egging on the Russians and the U.S. government for war so that they can make money. And again, that just does not comport with the actions of the Biden administration or its allies over the past several weeks. We've seen Biden, Blinken, and many diplomats and officials across the transatlantic community working tirelessly in order to avoid war, in order to avoid a conflict and needless bloodshed. So these three narratives are quite popular in Russian media, quite popular in some fringe American and Western media, and certainly being shared on platforms like TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter.
Do you think that war is inevitable at this point?
Well, I do try to avoid crystal ball predictions because Mr. Putin is extremely unpredictable himself and is increasingly isolated these days because of COVID-19. So we don't have as much insight as we might want or think. The one thing I will say is that, you know, not only has the intelligence that's been coming out of the US and UK governments that's being declassified, it's quite compelling. It matches the Russian playbook from what we've seen for the past 15 to 20 years. But we're also seeing so much open source evidence, things that regular Russians and Belarusians are posting, showing huge columns of tanks and artillery, you know, filing past on train tracks and soldiers in their towns. And we have satellite imagery confirming all of this stuff as well. It doesn't seem like this sort of buildup would happen just as a bluff. It would be expensive. And frankly, I don't think it is the bargaining chip that President Putin hopes for. And so I have a hard time seeing where else this could go. I hope that the Western countries can de-escalate and avoid this needless bloodshed. But we've seen Putin make choices like this before in places like Chechnya or Georgia, for that matter, where he just can't be, you know, backed down from this sort of situation. So I'm not particularly optimistic right now, but I very much hope, as somebody who cares about, you know, democracy and the Ukrainian people, having lived there myself, that it is avoidable, but it's going to take a lot of work.
And there isn't, it doesn't seem, a lot more time left.
Yeah, I would agree with that. We're seeing more and more battalions being moved around to strategic positions on Ukraine's border, more troops being added, helicopters buzzing near the border, bridges being built, an escalation in the Donbas, which has already suffered greatly over the past 8 years of war. Things don't seem to be pointing in a positive direction right now.
Nina Jankowicz from the Wilson Center and author of the book, How to Lose the Information War, Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. Nina, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, is it possible to change your personality? A journalist gave herself 3 months to try. Her results next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Imagine for a second that you could change your personality. What would you want it to be like? Would you want to be more outgoing? Would you want to be funnier, more relaxed, or more driven? Well, Olga Khazan, who's a staff writer for The Atlantic, actually tried to do it. She tried to change her personality because, as she admits, she doesn't really like it. And other people don't like her personality either. So she signed up for an improv class. She started a gratitude journal and she went to an anger management class. She was, by the way, the only one not court ordered to be there. And then she wrote all about it for a big piece in The Atlantic. Her story is called I Gave Myself 3 Months to Change My Personality. And Olga Khazan joins me now. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, 3 months doesn't seem that long to change who you are, your core essence. Did you really think you could do it in 3 months?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that some of the studies on personality change actually also only track people for 3 months. So they usually take place over the course of one college semester. So that's about three-ish, a little over 3 months. I was hoping that that would be long enough of a time, but also, you know, just deadlines and, you know, the magazine print schedule. So I had to end eventually.
Well, okay. So how does one measure personality? So you had to take a test to determine your core personality before you started. What is it and what do they measure?
Yeah. So the kind of most validated measure of personality is the 5-factor model. What I did is I went to this website that was created by this professor, Nate Hudson, called personalityassessor.com. And I took a test kind of about things I like, things I dislike. So like whether I like poetry or whether I like parties. I do not radiate joy, so I could strongly disagree with that one. And it kind of gave me a sense of where I rank on various on each of these 5 factors of my personality in relation to other people.
What are the 5 factors?
Yeah, so the 5 factors are extroversion, which I think most people are pretty familiar with, agreeableness, which is sort of how warm and empathetic you are, openness to experience, which is sort of how receptive you are to new ideas, neuroticism, which is how depressed and anxious you are, and conscientiousness, which is sort of how self-disciplined and organized you are.
So I imagine most people want to score high on 4 of those. The extroversion, the openness, the agreeableness, the conscientiousness, and maybe not so high on the neuroticism part. Right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the other than neuroticism, the other four are associated with well-being. So people tend to be kind of happier and healthier when they're higher on those. And neuroticism, you're supposed to be low on, but I'm unfortunately very high on.
Well, there are certain personality traits associated with certain kinds of people. And, you know, some people from certain parts of the world are just more neurotic than others, right?
It could be, yeah. I mean, it's also, there's some studies that show that your profession can actually make you a little bit more neurotic. So if you have a very stressful job, as I do, it can actually make you more neurotic. So I've heard since the story came out from a lot of journalists being like, oh my gosh, I'm neurotic too. And I think that might be part of what's going on there.
Yeah, or living in a big city, all of that kind of stuff. And I guess the question is, are you neurotic and you choose this job, or does the job make you neurotic? Like, are you drawn to certain professions? Are people who are neurotic drawn to journalism, or I don't know, the other way around?
Yeah, I mean, it could be. I don't actually know the answer to that. I do have one funny tweet, which I came across in the course of my research, which is, why did everyone with an anxiety disorder decide to become a journalist? Which is, I think, pretty accurate and true.
Yeah. Okay, so you scored what on this test?
So I scored very high on neuroticism, and then I scored really low on extroversion. And so those were the two that I was working hardest to kind of improve on or change. And I also scored average on agreeableness, and I was hoping to kind of bump that up a little bit higher. I didn't want to be just in the middle. I wanted to be more agreeable than average.
You wrote that most people don't like your personality. Why is that? You seem very personable to me right now. Very agreeable.
I'm also doing a radio interview. But I mean, you know, the feedback that I've gotten from people in my life is, you know, you're always so anxious, or you're always worried, or, you know, you never want to go out. You never want to, you know, and I kind of, there came a point where I was sort of thinking, you know, do I want to be the person who's like, known for being kind of a recluse and being kind of withdrawn and worried and upset all the time. And I wanted to change that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's not fun, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't make you happy.
Yeah.
Well, so I guess that gets at the core question, and that is, how much of it is predetermined and how much of it is changeable, nature, nurture?
Yeah, so it's hard to say exactly. Like, you have, you know, 50% of it is up to you. 30 to 50% of your personality is at least influenced by your genes. But then kind of on top of that, the way you interact with the environment also influences your personality. And what I mean by that is, let's say you're kind of a generally open-minded child. You really like new experiences and like new hobbies and new things. That might make you more likely to go to college. And college actually tends to make people even more open-minded and exposes them to even more new ideas and new foods and new cultures and things like that. So your openness to experience is likely to grow over that time, but it's not entirely genetic, right? It's kind of this feedback loop or virtuous circle where you kind of have a certain proclivity, so you seek out those environments, so that kind of boosts that part of your personality. And that happens in a lot of ways. And, you know, extroverts kind of tend to meet a lot of people and make a lot of friends, and their friends make them happy, so they become even more extroverted, you know. So it's a little hard to say, but the bottom line is that you do have a lot of wiggle room there, because you can put yourself into environments where your personality has a chance to change.
And does it change for good, or is it just faking it? Like, you can be extroverted in the moment, but then once you get back to your house, you can kind of go, oh, finally, I don't have to be around these people anymore.
It's both. Faking it is changing for good. So you absolutely have to fake it. There's not like a magic spell that Nate Hudson can do to make you different. So for example, for extroversion, one of the things that I did was go to improv. And I did not want to go to improv. I did not like the first few classes of improv that I did. I wrote that I wanted someone to knock me unconscious rather than do improv. So when I was doing improv, I was faking it, absolutely. Like, I did not want to be there. I did not feel like a natural improviser. But kind of the more I did it, the more I realized, like, hey, I actually really like this. And it's actually really fun. And it kind of taps into a part of me that I didn't really realize was there, and that I didn't really ever give a chance to kind of flourish. And so now I'm actually still doing improv, even though the article is over and I don't have to do it anymore. So I don't know. Did I fake liking improv? I think so at the beginning, but now I'm not faking it anymore and I still like it. And it's probably making me more extroverted still. So that's sort of how it works with a lot of things.
Okay, so you worked on the extroversion. You also worked on the neuroticism, trying to lessen that. What did you do to attack that?
That was a lot of gratitude journaling and meditating. And I would say that the meditating worked better than the journaling. The journaling, I really just find expressing gratitude so unnatural that it just felt so contrived. And when I didn't have to do it anymore, I was like, oh my God, thank God. it's over. But the meditating, I actually found a way to do it that I found really helpful and that I think did bring down my neuroticism score a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, the gratitude journaling, that just seems anathema to journalists, really, which I guess is also part of the core personality issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's a profession where you're always on the lookout for problems, right? And like,
right, exactly.
Oh, how can I find like the true cause of this homelessness? You know, and it's very negative. And you're not really supposed to take a minute and think about all the things that are going right. So it just felt really unnatural to me.
Okay, so you liked the meditating and you liked the improv. And you're still doing both.
I'm not meditating as often as I should, but I still try to meditate. I still do improv and I still am trying to reach out to people and befriend them and, kind of not live so quite inside my bubble. It's very hard to make friends as an adult. But I am, giving it my best and it's really, I was never really a very natural friend maker in general. So the whole experience is kind of new to me.
So do people like you more now?
Unfortunately, as soon as I was done with this, Omicron happened. And I went to improv for the first time again, like for my next kind of round of it the other week. And I realized that I hadn't actually left my house or talked to anyone in like weeks and weeks prior to that. So I am not totally sure. I guess I will have to voice myself on the world and see how they react.
But you did take a test after the 3 months and had your scores improved?
Yeah. So my neuroticism did go down. My extroversion did go up, which was good. Those I both wanted. But my agreeableness also went down. From average to low. And I'm not sure why. I think, maybe I just became a little bit more cynical or something. Or maybe I pushed back against all the gratitude journaling and all the like... nicey time that I was supposed to be having and felt like, became even more of a Grinch. So I don't know.
So given all your experience with this, how do you assess this field of study, personality science, if you will? Do you think it's a real thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, these studies are happening and they're, have been published. And I think that's definitely real. I think it's worth trying. Like, do I think that everyone is going to be able to completely change their personality, 180 degrees overnight with minimal effort? I'm not so sure about that. And I don't know that very many people would want to. But if you want to make modest improvements or just to get out of your shell a little bit, or, I've been hearing from a lot of people whose neuroticism really does affect their life negatively. I think there's definitely ways to work on that and improve on those traits, through some of the activities that I did. And, other activities without kind of disrupting your life or completely becoming unrecognizable.
Yeah. Because do you fundamentally like your core personality and you don't want to monkey around with it too much?
When you say do you mean people or me?
No, I mean you, Olga.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's good as a journalist to be a little bit cynical maybe and a little bit skeptical. So I wouldn't want to become, a totally gullible Pollyanna. but then maybe I would go do, something more upbeat for a living. I don't know. It's hard to say what different choices I would have made if I had a different personality.
Olga Hazan is a staff writer for The Atlantic, and you can read her account of how she gave herself 3 months to change her personality in the current issue. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, we'll have your weekend movie reviews.
It's the anticipation of this wolf attack, because it sets this premise very early on that this can happen in any moment. It very much feels like an 18th century version of Jaws in that respect.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It is time to talk about new movies this week. There's a dog named Lulu, a couple of horror films, and a movie based on a video game. And here to tell us if they're any good is Whitney Seibold. He's a contributor to Slash Film and co-host of the podcast Critically Acclaimed. Hi, Whitney.
Hello. Thank you for having me back.
Great to have you back. And also rejoining us is Jacqueline Coley, an editor for Rotten Tomatoes and co-host of the podcast Rotten Tomatoes Is Wrong. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hey, Madeline. So glad to be back.
So glad to have you back. Okay, first up, we have Dog. This is a comedy that stars Channing Tatum as an Army Ranger who befriends a military dog named Lulu.
Sergeant Rodriguez was a legend.
Family funeral Sunday outside of Nogales.
They want his dog at the funeral. You do this and you're back in the game. She won't work with anyone. One minute she's good, the next minute she's sending three guys to the ER.
What's up, dog?
And you're gonna go on a little road trip.
Easy.
What are y'all so scared of? Smell it out, big time.
What is your deal, man?
Maybe just take the crazy down one notch.
Hey! No!
All right, Jacqueline, this sounds like a buddy movie with a dog.
Yes, it is a buddy movie. It is a road trip movie, and it is a veteran once returned home movie. And if all of those sound very familiar, then you're definitely going to feel right at home with this one. But I will say, this is Channing Tatum and Reed Carling directing this together. It's Channing's feature directorial sort of debut. And honestly, I will have to say their partnership over films like Magic Mike and Stop Loss is the reason why I feel this one sort of avoids all the pitfalls of those very formulaic sort of Lifetime type fare. And honestly, I had no problem just falling in love with Channing Tatum and his dog as they traveled across country, and was highly, highly entertained.
And the dog, how is the dog's acting chops, so to speak?
Honestly, legit. Like, there's a turn with Lulu. Like, legitimately, let's give Lulu the Bark Award. Like, I know there's like a award at Cannes for the best animal performance, but if they could do that year round, I have a feeling Lulu would win. And the acting in this is very physical. Like, he attacks and does all of that stuff as a Belgian monoholist dog. That's sort of like what they're known for, is protecting and sort of like militaristic type events. And there's a lot that the dog literally teaches the human, which is sort of, again, a trope of these films, but it is done so well in this one.
Whitney, what did you think?
I agree. This is unbelievably filled with tropes. A road movie about somebody driving in a car with an animal is literally the same story as Sonic the Hedgehog. But in this case, Channing Tatum brings this weird kind of laid back humanity, not just to his character, but also to the direction, to the point where everything feels really, really casual. So when something that might feel like a contrived moment comes up, like where he has to have a moment of self-reflection or a moment of survival, it feels a lot more natural. It feels a lot more earned and a lot more lived in than something that you might see in Sonic the Hedgehog. And as such, something really contrived does feel a little bit fresh.
Okay, Dog in wide release in theaters beginning today. Next up, we have the action film Uncharted. It stars Tom Holland and Channing Tatum lookalike Mark Wahlberg on the hunt for a treasure lost during the Magellan Expedition.
Hey, kid. A little young for a bartender, aren't you?
A little old for prom, aren't you? Leaves are
falling all around. Everything in here. Why the map?
This path Ferdinand Magellan took to sail around the world.
You know your history.
It's the biggest treasure that's never been found.
5 billion, easy. I think you're here because you're your brother.
Well, you know my brother, Sam.
All right, Jacqueline, this is based on a Sony PlayStation video game. Does it work as a movie?
Wow, I'm going to have to go ahead and call myself out here. I've played too many hours of Uncharted, I feel, to even be a correct arbitrator of the worthiness of this film. I am an unabashed Nathan Drake fan. And although I am sitting in this film saying to myself, this is not it, I so enjoyed it. I'm not going to lie. This movie is not one where I think the connective tissue, the plotting, how it makes sense. There's a lot of Indiana Jones homage with not a lot of real thought behind the plotting of any of this. But I can't lie, man. I had a blast. I had so much fun watching Tom Holland give his best Indiana Jones cosplay with Antonio Banderas and Mark Wahlberg just showing up for the ride. And I think the check.
Yeah, that's what it does seem like watching the preview. But it's a good time. Is it as fun as an Indiana Jones movie?
I would say this. It's as fun as playing Uncharted. But for folks that were a fan of that video game series, and I must admit, it may not be one that is like ringing off the tongue. It was a very popular video game franchise. And there's homages to that that feel directly pulled out of the game. And when it is closest to the game is when it's actually the most fun. Ruben Fleischer has made a name for himself with the Venom series of just making fun, turn off your brain action that I can rail against for the cinematic I would say pitfalls of it, but I cannot pretend he doesn't know how to make an audience have a great time.
Okay, Uncharted, also in wide release today. Next up, we have the British horror film A Banquet. It's the debut from Scottish director Ruth Paxton, and it follows a newly widowed mom whose daughter becomes possessed.
My body sometimes just shuts off. I get nauseous around foods.
You're unwell.
We'll figure this out, okay?
I can feel something inside of me. I've been chosen.
Okay, Sienna Guillory, who starred in Resident Evil and that franchise, plays the mom. Jessica Alexander plays the daughter. Whitney, what did you think?
The preview makes it sound like it's a horror movie, but this is a far more complex movie than just a possession thriller, because the main character is widowed. We get to actually see the father of this family take his own life early in the movie, and the older daughter witnesses it. Fast forward a few months, and the daughter has this vision. She looks up into the sky and afterwards realizes that she has a severe aversion to food and eating. She just can't eat. There's this really harrowing scene where her mother tries to get her to eat a single pea at dinner. And as the film goes on and months pass, we realize that she hasn't eaten, but she's not losing any weight. And this isn't so much a demonic possession thriller as it is perhaps a divine possession thriller. The mother has to kind of come to terms with the fact that her daughter is going through this weird sort of spiritual awakening that is manifesting itself in this bizarrely supernatural way where her body is not accepting food anymore. Ruth Paxton is clearly getting at something, not just about eating disorders and grieving, but also about this weird sort of performative fasting that has long been a part of Christian traditions. So you could argue that this is a Christian movie as well, but it also doesn't come to any kind of solid conclusions about what's really going on. There's a lot of ambiguities going on, which might be frustrating for a lot of audiences. It doesn't let you know that a demon is in the person's body and they need to call an exorcist and there's a set of rules that they need to abide by. Instead, it's leaving us with a lot of these interesting concepts that it's just sort of sprinkling throughout, and how the fasting process is spreading out into the world. It's vague, and yet it's really, really intriguing at the same time. I really liked it.
Yeah, well, often anorexia is referred to as some alien creature that has taken over a young woman's body, or even in some cases a young man's body, that it's not them, that the disease is controlling them, in other words. So like an alien.
And I'm guessing Ruth Paxton is indeed making a comment on anorexia and how grief and eating disorders can often interlink, but the film never outright says that. There's not a meeting with a psychiatrist where they say, this is exactly what's happening and then here's what you need to do to deal with it. We get to sort of see the process from the ground up, as it were.
And so this premiered at TIFF last year. And how did it do? What was the reception?
I know that some critics were frustrated by the lack of definition, whether this was a psychological movie, whether this was a supernatural movie. It seems to be kind of a blend of the two. And that can be really unsatisfying for a lot of critics or a lot of audiences who want it to be a straight up thriller. And there are thrilling elements to it. But more than anything, it's a downbeat psychological drama that they have to sell as a thriller. Otherwise, you know, there's not really much of an advertising angle.
Right. People might not go see it. Okay. A Banquet is in theaters beginning tomorrow. Next up, a horror film called The Cursed. It premiered at Sundance last year. It's set in rural 19th century France, where a small village appears to be cursed.
What's happening here? Lands and cursed.
Okay, I think there's some cursing going on here. Jacqueline, this is directed by Sean Ellis. A pathologist shows up to figure out what's going on in this village. Is it or is it not cursed? And then what happens?
Yeah, so we essentially go into this remote village and it realizes that it's being terrorized by an unseen force. We have this Van Helsing type anthropologist sort of coming in trying to figure out what is terrorizing the town. And we come to realize that there may be roots within the town that are sort of an effort to sort of keep the monster going. It's an old-fashioned monster movie set in the 1800s. But what really I think makes it different is the characters that are in it, and it's especially Boyd Holbrook and Kelly Riley. There's just so many, I think, interesting takes to the werewolf spin in this one by putting it as a period piece. Again, another familiar beat type tale. When it premiered at Sundance, it was called Eighth for Silver. And I get why they changed the name. It's a little bit more ambiguous here, but I think if you're a monster movie fan, I didn't see A Banquet, but I don't think you'll be as disappointed with this one if you were looking for something more straightforward, really engrossing, and honestly, quite scary.
Really? A lot of jump scares?
It's not even the jump scares. It's the anticipation of this wolf attack, because it sets this premise very early on that this can happen in any moment. It very much feels like an 18th century version of Jaws in that respect.
Oh, okay. Whitney?
It's utterly thrilling. The monster is really scary. The gore effects are pretty spectacular. You know, people lose limbs left and right. It's really fun. It's incredibly stylish as well. The photography is gorgeous. Everything's really sort of hazy and indistinct. You can feel the beast sort of creeping around in the haze around the edge of the frame. And there's a shot early on in the movie where the werewolf is eventually evoked because as a revenge tactic by the local Roma clan, who is trying to be scared off of their land by the local English gentry. There's this one single static shot. It's a lockdown camera shot where we get to see the ransacking of this town just from afar. And the frame is like impeccably choreographed, and it's completely horrific, of course, but it's unbelievably good filmmaking, and that sort of creativity is brought out into the rest of the movie. So you're always waiting for something to appear in the edge of the frame. Your eye is searching around a lot. That makes you all the more intrigued and all the more involved and waiting for this monster to show up. So of course, when it does, it's all the more thrilling. There's also a fear in a movie like this that if you keep the monster off camera for too much, when you finally see it, it's going to let you down. And that's not the case with The Cursed. I love the way the monster looked. I love the way it attacked people. I love the way that you didn't know who was going to live or die in any given scene. It's just a good, taut, really well-made monster film.
Is this a movie you take kids to, or no? Too scary?
Far too gory.
Yeah, I was going to say, okay. I would not.
You could take a 17-year-old to it, but no, I wouldn't recommend you take your kids to see this.
Okay, The Cursed in wide release today. And hey, since I have you both here and the Academy Awards are just around the corner, I'm just wondering what your best picture pick is for the last year.
The smart money this year is on Jane Campion's Power of the Dog. And you know what? I think that's also my favorite of the best picture nominees as well. It's good deconstructionist Western, of course, but it's also just really excellent filmmaking.
Jacqueline.
my personal favorite film that I saw in 2021 is actually getting a 2022 release, and it's called Pleasure. It is absolutely the craziest sex worker film I've seen. And my number one movie that was actually released is probably Red Rocket, which is another sex worker film, which is directed by Sean Baker. A very sad note, a woman that acted in that actually recently died of a stroke. And again, Sean is known for these first time actors. And so it's just one of those things where I really want folks to maybe check out that film and see her incredible performance now that she is no longer with us. So Pleasure and Red Rocket. Check out Pleasure this year. And even though it's not up for the Academy Awards, it won the Oscar in my heart with Red Rocket.
Yeah, Sean Baker. I love Tangerine that he shot on an iPhone.
Yep.
Interesting movie. All right. Well, thanks, you guys. And happy weekend. Happy holiday weekend, actually.
Yes,
happy holiday weekend.
Yeah. Lots of time to watch movies. Jacqueline Coley is an editor for Rotten Tomatoes and co-host of the podcast Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong. Whitney Seibold is a contributor to Slash Film and co-host of the podcast Critically Acclaimed. Coming up, Evan Kleinman is here with some recipes for zhuzhing up your green salad. That is next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lentils?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
Well, maybe you overindulged just a wee bit in the past few days. Valentine's Day, Super Bowl Sunday. Well, it is a good time maybe to make a big salad for your next meal. And Evan Kleinman is here with some salad dressing ideas to make those greens and veggies go down easily. She hosts KCRW's Good Food. Hi, Evan.
Hi.
I love salad, so I don't know why I'm slagging it off there, because I would eat it every day if I could.
Me too. I mean, I grew up in a household where there was salad every night for dinner. So for me, not having salad is like not having a head. Just like, but I know a lot
of lettuce.
But I know a lot of people don't feel that way. And so, you know, a big bowl of salad can be a great transition from a momentary fall into a vat of carbs and fat. And a good dressing can be what makes that bowl craveable instead of feeling punitive.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so you asked your followers on social media what their favorite dressings are, and what did they tell you?
Well, it wasn't that much of a surprise to hear that blue cheese dressing was the winner. It's the dressing that we tend to order when we go out and splurge items we don't make at home, and it's really hard to beat that umami sharpness of a good blue cheese. Other dressings with a thicker texture were also popular, like Green Goddess. And of course, the beloved ranch is still holding forth.
Mm. So people like those white creamy dressings?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, they like things that nap the leaves. I heard more about emulsified dressings than I did about vinaigrettes, for example.
Well, do you like blue cheese dressing?
I love
think that's
blue
a
cheese.
Controversial take. Really?
I love blue cheese.
But it has to be on a sturdy lettuce, right? Not like
well,
a
I happen mesclun. To love it on yeah, I happen to love it on really crisp lettuce, so either a wedge or on romaine.
Yeah.
And it can be, have many different characters depending on the blue cheese you choose. I mean, it can be a blue. And blue cheeses, you know, run the gamut from being very sharp to more mild. It could be a Roquefort, which is the most complex and the bluest of the blue. Or it could be Gorgonzola, which I really, really love. It's very stinky, that's true. But once you get it into a dressing, it has a sweetness that the other two don't have.
Okay, so you heard some more unique dressings. You heard about almond and tahini dressings too. So talk about those.
Yeah, I mean, what I love about doing these shout outs is I find out things that I never knew before. So There's a restaurant called Jame Enoteca down in El Segundo. The chef is Chef Jackson Kalb, who also has OSPI in Venice. And he's known as a really incredible pasta chef. But people go nuts for this kale salad he makes with an almond vinaigrette that has a little bit of spiciness. And I think that including nuts or seeds, which obviously tahini-based dressings would be seeds, in a dressing is smart because the protein really helps blunt your appetite too. And in the case of the nuts, you have a lot of that texture to chew on.
Well, how do you incorporate the nuts? Do you puree them? Do you make them into a butter or...
No, in this case, it's more a vinaigrette style into which he is putting quite a lot of chopped roasted almonds. And then in addition to this kale salad, which is absolutely gorgeous, we'll have a photograph of it on the web, he also garnishes it with more roasted almonds. But it's a tower of beauty, that salad.
All right, what about tahini dressings? And what is that?
Well, I mean, so many of us are eating more Middle Eastern food these days. We're all used to putting tahini on our falafel, or it can become kind of like something that we use on a lot of things. I mean, like on fish. It's just the idea of taking tahini, which has this incredible texture, and using it to do something like sub out mayonnaise is an idea that many chefs use. And I happened to talk to Chef Jasmine Shimoda, who has Jewel in Silver Lake. And she does that quite a bit. She makes a green goddess salad dressing in which she just decided one day to switch up the tahini for the mayonnaise. And it, you know, she loved it. It was much more healthy and gave sort of that deep kind of great nuttiness that tahini has to the dressing. And she also really loves this tahini citrus dressing that she does during this time of year when we have so many different citrus on display. And she'll make it with anything she has to hand. And she says it's as good on fish or chicken as it is on a salad. So that's always good to have something that is, you know, versatile.
Yeah. Well, neither one of these dressings sounds particularly low-cal if you're looking to do that with your salad.
I mean, there are people for whom the lettuce is just a vehicle for the dressing. And I think when we use blue cheese dressing, that might be the case. But I mean, if you're making a good salad, you shouldn't be using that much salad dressing. Just enough to lubricate the leaves a little bit. You don't have to drench it.
What about a vinaigrette that is just a basic vinaigrette? Do you have one in your pocket that you go to?
Well, for me, you know, I do the Italian dressing thing where I salt the greens, then I add a bit of olive oil and then either lemon juice or vinegar. I love red wine vinegar. And then, of course, for years I've made it was my mother's dressing, which ended up becoming the most popular dressing at Angeli. And that was, you know, oil, red wine vinegar, a ton of garlic, and a handful of Parmesan cheese.
Mm. Now, do you put that just directly onto the leaves or do you put it in a bowl or something and mix it up first?
Well, that I put it in a bowl. If it has more than olive oil and an acid, then I'm putting it in a bowl and mixing it up. Even if growing up, we just made the dressing at the bottom of the bowl. And somehow it was always the right amount.
Yeah. Sometimes if you're doing it over and over again, if you're having salad at every dinner, you kind of can do it just like that.
Definitely.
Evan Kleiman is the host of KCRW's Good Food. And what is on your show this week?
This week, we have Leanne Brown, who had a huge hit of a cookbook a few years ago about how to eat really inexpensively. In this book, she gets really personal with her feelings of self-doubt and anxiety through the lens of food. And a beloved local chef, Elisa Reynolds of My Two Cents on Pico, is the subject of our In the Weeds segment this week. And then we talked to a journalist who did a deep dive into the simulation video game, The Sims, and how it's evolved into a virtual food experience for users.
Really? So you're eating, but you're not eating when you're playing the game?
Yeah, they've created all these expansion packs that have a ton of different dishes from all over the world. So gamers who come from places where there isn't much food diversity, or maybe they're really young and they haven't explored the world of food yet, are getting to have this kind of virtual peek into this incredible world of food that's out there.
That sounds really fun. KCRW's Good Food, Saturday mornings at 11 and wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find Evan's recipes for salad dressing at kcrw.com/pressplay. That is also where you can sign up for a podcast if you so wish to do so. That does it for this week on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Tuesday.